thanks to Joe Bailey for Drive. Another great show, Joe. Make sure you tune in tomorrow at 3 o'clock for more of the same. From now until 7, it's me, Darren Mood, to Cricket All The Way with 98 Not Out.
On 98 FM and online, this is Phoenix FM. This is Phoenix 98 FM. Weather.
Well, let's start off with the weather. Tonight, we'll see largely clear skies with just a few patches of cloud lingering. The skies will also remain largely clear throughout the latter stages of the overnight period. On to tomorrow, the morning will start with dry conditions and plenty of wintry sunshine. A few patches of cloud will drift in during the afternoon, but there will still be plenty of wintry sunshine. Sounds decent. The outlook for the weekend on Saturday, turning milder into the weekend. Saturday looks to be murky, generally cloudy and breezy, but staying dry. Chance of a few brighter breaks in places. And Sunday looks to remain breezy with variable cloud and bright spells. There may be the odd shower. Lows tonight of 6 degrees and highs tomorrow of 7.
Lovely cricket, cricket lick the ball before it reached the...
Welcome along to 98 Not Out with me, Darren Mutu. Phoenix FM's weekly cricket show, 98 Not Out, for you from now until 7 o'clock. Lots to cram in tonight. We'll be catching up on how England are getting on out in the West Indies as their tour continues. There's some county news. In particular, I'll be taking a look at what's happened at Essex in the last 7 days. Special guest tonight, Ian Bishop, who reports in from Barbados. And there's some music and all the other usual bits and pieces. Don't go anywhere.
Lovely cricket, cricket lick the ball before it reach the wicket.
And of course, a reminder, you are listening to Phoenix FM. On the FM dial in the central Essex area, just look for 98. You can listen via the internet. Head to the Phoenix FM website, phoenixfm.com, and click on Listen Live. You can also shout at your smart speaker to play Phoenix FM. Many ways to listen. And of course, if you can't stay the course tonight, or you want to just check it out later or listen back, head to phoenixfm.com and search for 98 Not Out. You can download the show. And don't forget the podcast as well.
Talking about a cricket, lovely cricket, got to lick the ball before it reach the wicket, talking in a different style.
All right, let's get this show on the road. It's cricket birthdays of the week. And it's a very happy birthday to the following from the world of cricket. First off, Tim Southey from New Zealand. He's 35. Jackson Bird, 37. Teflon Tom Harrison, who's counting his millions. He hits 52. Yuvraj Singh, 42. Michael DiVenuto, 50. Raise your bat, sir. Matt Henry, 32. West Indies legend Charlie Griffith, 85. And another Windies big name, Carl Hooper, 57. Former Essex player Dennis Canaria hits 43. Another Windies player, Joel Garner, 71. And finally, Craig White is 54. And a special happy birthday to listener Lucy Bushell, who's celebrating her birthday tomorrow evening. Happy birthday, Lucy. And remember, if you want to have your name added to the birthday list, just send me an email, radio@phoenixfm.com. Title the mail 98 and out. Tell me whose birthday it is, a little bit about them, how old they are. Go on. I dare you. And I'll read it out on air. And of course, if you want to get in touch to discuss anything or ask me a question, use that same email address, radio@phoenixfm.com. Or you can also head to Facebook and give the 98 Not Out Facebook page a like, or on Twitter or on Instagram, and use all the message functions there to reach out and let me know what you think.
Phoenix FM.
Right, let's start off with England, and uncapped 20-year-old Somerset off-spinner Shoaib Bashir has been named in England's squad for the five-match test series against India. Bashir has only played six first-class matches, having made his debut back in June. I know Andy Chave is very pleased about this, and all you Somerset fans out there will be rooting him on. Hopefully he gets picked and has a decent series. Surrey fast bowler Gus Atkinson and Lancashire left-arm spinner Tom Hartley, who have also represented England in white ball cricket but are uncapped at test level, are also included. The first test starts in Hyderabad on the 25th of January. Batter and vice-captain Ollie Pope and left-arm spinner Jack Leach returned to the side after injuries. You might remember that Pope dislocated his shoulder in the summer's second Ashes test at Lord's, while Leach missed out entirely from that series with a stress fracture of the back. Ben Stokes leads the side after undergoing surgery on his knee following England's 50-over World Cup campaign, but he will only play as a batter. Well, that's the future. Let's come back to the present, and let's head out to the West Indies, where England are continuing their white ball tour. The ODI section is complete and has ended with a rather depressing 2-1 loss to a resurgent West Indies side. Remember, they didn't even qualify for the World Cup. England still definitely in a rebuilding phase, but they've now moved on to the T20 leg of this tour. It's a five-match series, but the losing streak continues. England let a dominant position slip as they fell to a four-wicket defeat by the West Indies in the opening game in Bridgetown. Captain Jos Buttler and Phil Salt took the tourists to 77 for naught at the end of the power play, and that became 112 for 2 at the halfway stage before England collapsed in the second half of the innings to be bowled out for 171. Andre Russell making his West Indies his first West Indies appearance since November 2021 was the pick of the bowlers. He took 3 for 19, while Romario Shepherd also impressed with figures of 2 for 22. The Windies also made a flying start to their innings before being pegged back, with England leg spinner Adil Rashid taking his 100th T20 international wicket in his 100th match. And you may have seen across social media, it was a really nice presentation to mark his 100th match by Freddie Flintoff, who continues to improve and look better and looks very, very comfortable in being part of the England setup. So well done and congratulations to Adil Rashid. Now, after a brief delay for rain, Rehan Ahmed ramped up the pressure on the hosts with two wickets and two balls, only for the West Indies to hit back again through the experienced pair of captain Rovman Powell and the aforementioned Dre Russ. And with the required rate rising, Powell smacked Liam Livingstone for back-to-back sixes to put the home side back in the ascendancy. And with Russell soon joining in the final, West Indies ruthlessly finished the job. Powell ended unbeaten on 31 from 15 balls, and Russell hit the winning runs with 11 balls to spare to finish 29 not out from just 14 balls. As I said, England have already lost the ODI series in this tour, 2-1, and West Indies can celebrate a first home series win over England in the format since 1998. The teams now head to Grenada for the second T20 match, with the West Indies one up in the five-match series.
Across Brentwood and Billericay, this is Phoenix FM.
Now, I don't know if you caught it on social media this week, but there was a really interesting little snippet of an interview between George De Bell of The Cricketer and England's Rob Key, where, well, take a listen.
An elbow injury is a complicated place to have an injury. So we just want to take this as slow as possible. Jofra was keen to go into the IPL auction, but we just feel like actually the best way to do this now is for us to be in control of it, and we can then just bring you back, and we can, hopefully, because if it takes an extra couple of months, but he gets another couple of years out of his career, a bit more longevity, and he gets back fully, I think he's worth his weight in gold, Jofra.
Did he not play club cricket yesterday?
I don't know if he played club cricket yesterday.
I believe he played.
He may well have done, who knows.
Right.
But you're in the know, George.
Well, no, I'm asking. Well, it seems unusual that you wouldn't know. I mean, he started a three-day game for Foundation yesterday in Barbados. Were you not aware of that?
Okay. No, I'm not aware of that. I'll find out.
Oops. Orcs, I think, is what the youngsters of today would use to describe that. Just for the record, Jofra Archer played for his former school side in Barbados without the knowledge of Managing Director of England's Men's Cricket, Rob Key. Fast bowler Jofra Archer has not played since March because of this ongoing elbow injury. He was in Barbados with England's white ball side as part of his recovery, but reports tell me that he has since flown back to the UK. Just for the record, he took 4 for 18 for the Foundation against Lords on day one of a three-day match on Sunday, bowling a mix of pace and left-arm spin.
The December issue of the Cricketer magazine is out now, and we look back at England's disastrous World Cup campaign. Vic Marks says England wrote off 50-over cricket and paid the price, while George De Bell argues that Rob Key is under pressure for the first time. Editor Hugh Turbeville, meanwhile, argues that England seem to be winging it at the moment, while Barney Roney writes his final column for the Cricketer from the World Cup. And Nasser Hussain picks out where England went wrong. We also have an exclusive Stuart Broad interview. David Gower pays tribute to Sir Alistair Cook. We have an interview with Yorkshire's Finlay Bean and Darren Goff. And Mike Selvey pays tribute to Bisham Beddy. That's the December edition of the Cricketer magazine, out now.
Yeah, make sure you get your copy of The Cricketer. Always good at this time of year with the Christmas edition. And also, as Hugh mentioned in that little clip, congratulations go to Stuart Broad for making the shortlist for the BBC's Sports Personality of the Year. Make sure you vote for him. Let's have cricket back at the top of the tree.
Community radio for Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.
I am John Sharma, inviting you to join me here on Phoenix FM on Saturday afternoons for Phoenix Sport. The top local, national and international sports stories, plus live scores, results, reports, interviews, quiz questions and my sporting anniversaries. And lots of great music too. That's Phoenix Sport, every Saturday from 3 till 6pm here on Phoenix 98 FM.
Tune in to the Sunday Sessions on Phoenix FM every Sunday morning, 10 till 12, with me, Kevlar. I'll be bringing you tracks from local artists. Most of those tracks are recorded down at our open mic, which takes place every Monday at 8pm at the Essex Arms in Brentwood, right next door to Brentwood Station. Come along and just watch, or if you're a singer or songwriter, come along and sing us a song.
Sing, sing, sing.
It's me, Michelle Ward.
A prawn cocktail.
I love a prawn cocktail.
I'm always rambling. What is the mayor's chain called?
A chain.
In fact, I never stopped talking. And I rubbed basically all of the skin off the inside of my thigh. You can answer my question of the day.
Michelle.
I think men go through the menopause from about the ages of 18 to 65. And after that, they die. Fantastic guests and super music. What am I lacking in the diet? Humour, really?
Yes.
Weekdays 10 till 1.
And don't forget, John Chubb follows me at 7 o'clock with the excellent non-league hour. Then you've got the silky sounds of Gareth Williams, bumper to bumper, 8 until 10. And then Madeline Christie is here till midnight.
This is Phoenix FM.
Right, it has been a very active few days at Essex Cricket. Finally, they have published a summary version of the Newton Report into allegations of racist abuse and discriminatory treatment at the club. There has been a lengthy delay, but nonetheless, this report, though it's called a summary, really is quite detailed. Chairman Anu Mahindru said fundamental errors had been made in the past which did not reflect the Essex of today. Remember, some of these are quite historic. They go back over 10 years in one or two cases. Mahindru says significant progress has been made across the club to build a workplace that values and respects every individual, regardless of their background, identity and beliefs, he added in a statement. Following recommendations from the independent committee, the club is now dealing with the process concerning any individuals where sanctions may be imposed. The report said that other individuals came forward with further allegations of racially discriminatory treatment as the investigation progressed, which were added to its remit. Now, the complaints related to a period from the mid-1990s to 2013, and the report said they reflected a dressing room culture which regarded ethnic, racial and religious comments as banter. Those at the receiving end of this treatment were too scared to speak up for fear of damaging their prospects of selection and progression, the report continued. There was a lack of understanding of the needs of Muslim players, the catering was of an unacceptable standard, there were no proper prayer facilities, and little thought was given to the scheduling and location of team events during Ramadan. Now, the investigation also found that a former chairman used a racist language during a 2017 board meeting. Essex were fined £50,000 by the England and Wales Cricket Board last year after admitting to charges relating to that meeting. But although John Farragher, who is also not named in the report, resigned as chairman the previous year, he denies using racist language. The report also found that the former chairman acted in a bullying, condescending, threatening and intimidatory manner during a phone call with an individual who was standing for election to the General Committee, but they did say that he had not acted this way because of the individual's race. Essex has now set up a committee to consider possible sanctions against individuals as a result of the report, and Mahindru said that possibly there will be people that are still involved with the club. Now, there are 15 recommendations, which include the introduction of compulsory EDI, that's Equality, Diversity and Inclusion training, for everyone employed by the club. All allegations of discriminatory conduct must be investigated properly, thoroughly and impartially. They must also introduce fair recruitment and retention processes to ensure the award, extension and termination of contracts are free from bias or discrimination. They must monitor opportunities given to play in the first 11 to ensure they are fair, merit-based and free from bias. Operating objective, fair and inclusive recruitment processes for all posts, including coaching roles. Now, that's just sort of a summary of what has gone on, but I think there's general relief that this report has been published because it has been dragging on. But one of the delays was said to be the fact that more people came through, and also it should be noted that there were many that did not want to take part because of fear of reprisals of one sort or another. Now, Essex say they are about 80% through completing the recommendations, so it does kind of reflect what Mahindra is saying, that this is not the club today that it was back then. So that led to a fairly well-anticipated AGM at the club on Tuesday evening. I was there and it was good to see so many people that listen to this show and support Essex. Of course, Dan Hagger was there and the Grumbler, Richard Clark, as well, amongst others. Very impressive. On the panel were CEO John Stevenson, Chairman Anu Mahindru and Treasurer Neil Faraday. Apart from discussion about the Newton report, there were some interesting snippets that came out. There was a discussion about ground development, because anyone that's been to Chelmsford recently will know that it's in a fairly dismal state, and they are in the process of deciding on what to do and a possible relocation, and it's Chelmsford and one other undisclosed ground that will be thrown into the mix. And then when they've decided to make the final decision, they will decide on the redevelopment, the aim being to get to a seating capacity of at least 10,000 to fall in line with what the ECB is trying to do in terms of what counties should be expected. It's a tall ask, and I just think that this whole thing of the 100 being expanded to grounds, well, and I think in the ECB report they wanted at least 15,000, but this is going to take time, and really Essex do need to get their backside in gear. Neil Faraday, the Treasurer, gave a very interesting presentation which showed that the club was at the last set of accounts £700,000 in debt. Now, legal fees take up a large part of that, but he did illustrate that Essex are not really too dissimilar from other non-test hosting counties. So this does hold the mirror up to the state of finances. And I just read a piece today that Yorkshire are in deep, deep financial trouble. They're having to borrow from the ECB to pay wages to staff. And they are hinging on Mike Ashley, he of Sports Direct and former Newcastle United fame, on buying Headingley and trying to bail them out. But Yorkshire, I mean, there you are. That is a test hosting ground, and it is a 100 hosting ground as well. But still, the troubles continue. Faraday also went on to say that Essex will remain a members-only club. There's no intention whatsoever to change the model of that, so that will please members with that news. And also, there was a talk. There was a question asked and answered that Essex, the ground at Chelmsford, will remain an open ground, so people can move around. There was also news of the committee elections. I don't know if you call it committee or board these days, but those nominated were Alan Ball, Joe Farragher, Jason Gallion, Victoria Kyle, Clive Purdy, Piyush Somaya, and Graham Staples. Those that were elected on, Jason Gallion, Victoria Kyle, and Piyush Somaya. Commiserations to Alan Ball, Joe Farragher, Clive Purdy, and Graham Staples, who didn't get the vote. So all in all, I thought it was a really good meeting, well attended, and I thought that the CEO, the chair, and the treasurer gave really good accounts of themselves, particularly Mahindru, very firm, sounded like he was well on top of everything that's going on. There's still a lot of work to do, but clearly, in the background, while all of these investigations have been going on, the club has been acting and moving quickly, and I think the feeling is that they're not going to suffer such a grim fate as befell on Yorkshire, who had a 49-point deduction and a heavy fine, because basically they didn't do anything. And Essex have clearly been busy and are getting to work. There's still the ECB report to come, so let's see what happens there. But keep up the good work is what I'd say.
This is Phoenix 98 FM.
Right, time for our guest this evening, and it is Ian Bishop, who speaks to us from Barbados. Everyone knows him for his exploits as a fearsome West Indies fast bowler, but these days very well known and very recognisable as a commentator. Let's catch up with what he had to say. Just tell me what the weather's doing so I can depress myself even more.
I'll be realistic. I looked to my right and it's bright and sunny outside. I actually had to close the curtains because it was too bright coming through my glass sliding doors. But I hope it stays that way, because in Antigua we had a few rain interruptions and that was very unseasonal for that time of the year as far as I could recollect. So I'm hoping that Barbados gives us its best side weather-wise.
I know Barbados very well. Is it a slightly different weather pattern to Antigua? Because whenever I visit Barbados, you get rain showers, but they move on pretty quickly.
Similar in Antigua. They come, they go, because they're small islands and the wind is obviously so strong. Antigua fascinates me perhaps more than Barbados. Barbados can give you a good rain shower. In Antigua, I remember when we used to host the regional T20 tournament there, the old Stanford thing. We hardly ever lost a game, and that used to be down in, I can't remember the time of year, second half of the year, rainy season, and the rains were just piling, blow over, and we'd go again. So I'm hoping Kensington Oval is usually very good anyway, so fingers crossed.
Is Owen Stanford's name still mentioned in the Caribbean, or is it a bit of a dirty word?
That was the first time I used it for about... 10 years. I usually say the old regional T20 tournament, but in this case, I think you'd have very, very little understanding of what I meant. West Indian viewers, for me, I don't know whether it's used. I very seldom use it because I think it brings back a little sense of mixed feelings in terms of the structure of the thing. Was helpful. But the other side of it is something that I don't ever talk about.
Yeah, for UK viewers and listeners, there is a really good documentary about the whole Alan Stanford affair that's on Sky Sports Cricket, mm-hmm. which you can download mm-hmm. via the website. But
right.
We're not here to talk about negative things, Mr. Bishop. We're here to talk positive. So right. For younger viewers and listeners, they need to be informed. First of all, we're in the presence of West Indian bowling greatness. When you first started playing international cricket, you made quite an impact, and I'm actually slightly older than you, so I can remember your arrival on the scene very, very well.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I can remember that run up, that side on action.
Okay.
very devastating.
When you said greatness, I looked around to see Quigley and Wolf was behind me, because he's a great one, and he's in the room behind me, right behind me here as I speak now.
Who's that?
I look, Quigley Ambrose.
Oh, right.
Oh. Yeah,
those are the great guys. Mixed.
Ambrose, Wolf, yeah, I can bore a hole through the thingy. I'm sure he'll accommodate. I'll talk to him later, actually.
Thank you.
Yeah, himself and Walsh and Michael Oling, who was very good to me as a mentor when I started out at Derbyshire. I went to Derbyshire, actually, because he was a Derbyshire. Surrey had asked me, actually, had approached me, actually, to go to Surrey, and Mikey sort of swayed it the other way up at Derbyshire. Not sure why. But no, cricket, with all the injuries, even with all the injuries, it was a dream come true, because when I was young growing up, obviously, as an admirer of West Indies cricket and its players, I never thought that I would one day be one of them. And Bishop running in from the Kirk stall and just never sounded right until it actually happened. So I'm honoured and privileged.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite an era of those players coming through. And, you know, when I was a youngster, Michael Holding, you know, it was Viv Richards with the bat, but Michael Holding with the ball and that incredible smooth kind of elegant action of running in. He had the longest run up. I don't think anyone had a run up like that before him.
Right. Wes Hall, as we're in Barbados, Wes Hall might throw an argument your way, but that's another one I'll have to talk to when I see.
Another great name of West Indian cricket. That's right.
Yeah.
What are your fondest memories of playing the game?
There are a lot of memories, but I remember the first time I heard my name mentioned to be selected for the West Indies. I'd actually jumped on a plane, headed to the UK, jumped on a bus, and I'd headed up north to play for a club called Evenwood Cricket Club in 1988, very early in 1988. And I got off the bus, and the gentleman who came to pick me up said to me, "Bishop, I'm sorry, you're not going to be playing for us this season." And I was in shock, because I traveled all this way across to the UK. I was on a bus from London up north. And I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, you've just been selected for the West Indies." And I mean, that was a shocker to me. So he took me to an apartment where they had another local West Indian guy playing called Andrew Light, the late Andrew Light. And I remember getting into the apartment, watching the sun go down, watching the sun come back up. I didn't sleep a wink that night, and then I had to go back to London to meet up with the guys, the West Indies team, the next day. And I don't think I spoke a word when I got into the room with Dujon and Richards and Greenidge and Ains for about 2 weeks. So that was the start of it. In terms of a memorable game, I don't know. I just think the whole thing was fascinating. Fantastic. I have a few regrets in terms of games that we lost. World Cup semi-final in 96 in Mohali comes to mind, which I don't ever talk about that much. But no, I was privileged to play with Viv, to play with Desmond, to play with Gordon, and then to play with Courtney and Kirk Lee for a little bit longer was great.
We've celebrated his 70th birthday last week. Yes. And he doesn't look to be any different. The hair's a little thinner, but otherwise he looks the same.
He's kept himself remarkably well. I can see the difference, of course, having known him from the younger days. He's still very fit, but the muscles used to be bulging so much back in the day. But he's one of those guys who's aged brilliantly. And I was actually saying to some of the guys the other day, said it on air as well, the one thing I loved about Viv, and I still do, is that I don't ever remember raising his voice to me when I played under him. He was my first West Indies captain. But he didn't have to. He just had to look in your direction, and you knew whether he approved of you or he disapproved of what you were doing. But he always let you know where you stood with him. If he did not like you, he would say to your face, "I do not appreciate you or what you're doing." And I find that endearing in a sense, because he's not one of the guys to go behind your back and say something and in front of your face say something else. Very straight up guy. And I really do hope that he has another 25, 30 years on the face of the earth, because he means so much to people like myself he taught me about the passion of playing for West Indies and for people that look like us. So I don't want that to ever be lost.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of that natural swagger that he had. You know, I can see him coming down the pavilion steps, chewing that gum.
I wish I had appreciated the couple of years that I played with him a little bit more, because sitting in the dressing room, he'd just be sleeping, and he'd sometimes be sleeping while the game is going on, and he'd just jump up out of his sleep when a wicket fell and grab his hat and put it on and start chewing the gum and walk out to the middle. But I didn't appreciate his power as a player until one day, I can't remember whether it was 92, maybe, I was playing for Derbyshire against Glamorgan, and the spirit just got a hold of him that day, because I played a couple of games against him and he hadn't scored, and he got 100 in Pontypridd that day, and he backed away. I thought I was in the prime and operating at high pace, and he just backed away for one shot and slapped it over extra cover down to an old tree somewhere. And that just said to me how several great opposition bowlers in years gone by, when he was at his peak, because he was coming to the end of his career then, how they must have felt with this man. He, most destructive player I've ever seen.
And then you were witness to a kind of progression in that team, as you said, when Viv and Gordon Grange and Desi kind of moved aside, then there was the new breed that came through. Now you mentioned Curtly Ambrose, Courtney Walsh. Was Lara part of your playing days as well?
Yeah, I played from school, actually, with Brian from the under-14 level. I went to a school called Belmont Boys Secondary, and Brian was like the more established and esteemed Fatima College. So we've been battling against each other since the under-14 days. And I sort of preceded him into the West Indies team by a year, perhaps. I was in 88, he came in 89. Only because he had other duties, I think, like an under-19 World Cup. Otherwise, he would have been there almost immediately. So we transitioned. I saw the transition, and looking back now, I was saying to Curtly Ambrose the other day, we were discussing it, how clearly the demarcation was in terms of that great era. Marshall was still there, Dujon was still there, Viv obviously, Greenidge, Haynes, and Courtney Walsh had straddled that era from 84 into us. And we sort of, as Curtly said, these are Curtly's words, I'm not qualified to say this because I don't classify myself as a great bowler. Curtly certainly is. He said he could see how the standards or the abilities had just started to drop off after Greenidge and Haynes and Marshall and those guys moved on. And on reflection, I was saying I could also see it. So I could give some revisionist history. When people say the West Indies started struggling from maybe 2000 or just before, I could see a progression of struggles coming through even from the late 80s. I love the way that Mr. Ambrose really said it. You know, he said the standards and the abilities just started just tailing off a little bit. So, but still, Curtly said we still had the ability with himself and a few others, Lara, excellent player, Jimmy Adams, Chander Paul, to carry on winning, even though structurally it had started to dip.
West Indies has always had, even, I think, the West Indies were lucky in the 70s and 80s and the 90s of having so many world-class players. It was like a freak almost, because and there was this conveyor belt. But even in this sort of decline, but even then, in the decline, there have been flashes of brilliance. You've still had great players in the modern game. You look at sort of Shiv Chanderpaul,
Chris Gayle,
that's right, and even right up to Jason Holder and some of the guys now. Can you put your finger on what has happened that the success has been much harder to come by?
I won't pretend. I cannot sit here and pretend to be the know-it-all on that situation. And I won't pretend to. I think I can give you a part structurally in the Caribbean. I think we let it slip a bit with thinking that we'd continue to have the Lloyds, the Marshalls, the Walshes, the Ambrose, the Laras coming through without too much effort. That wasn't the case because there started to become other distractions of technology, of social life changing and evolving. And so pulling at the market share of the cricketer, we did not have the finances nor channel the finances into investing in better structures, pitches, coaches, coaching setups. All of those things are a part. What I would say is that, as you rightly said just now, if we go back to Ambrose coming through, Lara coming through after that, Gill, Sawan, Holder, Bravo, all of those, Pollards in a different type of game. There is still talent. There has always been talent, cohesively though. And for test match cricket, mostly challenged, it's been a problem of all of those issues of which I speak. So I see the West Indies Cricket Board, Cricket West Indies, of restarting the academy. I like that. I love that. I think get young guys in there, get better coaches. Some of the Haynes, the Greenwich, all those guys coaching at the grassroots level would be so fantastic. So there's talent there.
The other thing that I noticed, I'm a regular visitor to the West Indies.
Right.
It's still the passion and the interest. You know, you go on a weekend, you go past any piece of green or, you know, the local clubs, there are games going on and people in there nicely starched and pressed whites and play with enthusiasm. And under the trees, there are some of the old timers there giving their views and, you know, also if you go into any rum shop, you can easily get into a very intense conversation about the game. The passion is still there.
I've stayed away from the rum shop, sir. For obvious reasons. I wouldn't put my hand up to say that I'm a man of the people and you can find me hanging out at the street corner. It never happened anyway. But things have changed, you know, as you would very well know, in some ways. We're still... For example, here in Barbados, there are call-in programs. In Antigua, there are call-in programs, and they're fierce call-in programs. Some of them with blinkers on, but it tells you a little bit about the passion. This one should be dropped. That one, drop the entire team. And places, you go to Guyana, get rid of everyone. Why is Hitmire not playing? you know, so the passion is still there. But it's always been a hard region to govern because you're talking about disparate territories, different governments, long flights. I remember when we were growing up in Trinidad, I don't know if you've ever been to Trinidad, but I grew up in Port of Spain, so there's the Queen's Park Savannah, which we call the biggest roundabout in the world. It's about a couple of miles around it. But within that, there used to be, I would say, 20 cricket grounds spread across that entire pasture. And we played on matin pitches. And every weekend, as you said, there'd be 20 games of cricket going on at different spots, some crossing the others. And there used to be the mix of young players, senior players. Now what I'm hearing, I haven't been around club cricket for a couple of years, is that there are a lot of young guys playing and not a lot of older guys mixing and sharing their knowledge. So those are some of the areas that have changed. And that's why I think an academy in each territory has to be a must, not to mention T20 cricket, which West Indies have become better at, has taken a hold of many of the young players.
Yeah. Is it because you think they kind of look at the lifestyle and the rewards and they think, well, that's for me, but I'm not going to get that from playing test cricket, maybe?
Well, it could be, you know, it could be part of it in that, I remember when I was coming towards, I was still playing club cricket in Trinidad, so I was like about halfway maybe through my international career. And it started getting harder and harder for more senior players who had to work during the week to make available themselves for the entire weekend from 12 o'clock to 6 o'clock in the evening because they had families. They had to look after those families. The social world was changing, more demands on work life and family life. And so T20 cricket has hit a sweet spot for that reason. It's also fitted in well with West Indians who are aggressive batsmen mostly, not all, Craig Brathwaite would disagree with me totally, and Nkrumah Bonner would say, that's not the current version of me. And so it sat well with the Bravos, for example, to display their all-around skills, bowling, Narine, bowling, Pollard batting, and the time span was shorter. And so when the Gales and the Pollards and the Bravos and the Narines and these guys and the Badgeries, who are excellent, great players in this format, started changing the narrative, I could see why young players gravitated towards that and why little kids coming through wanted to play reverse sweep rather than a forward defensive. So it's all played a part.
So we mentioned a lot of names there. Bravos, Pollard, Richards, Marshall, Lloyd, Lara. But there's one name we haven't mentioned. One name. Now, let me remember the name.
Oh. All right. Okay. That's embarrassing.
The moment that Mr. Ian Bishop wrote himself into cricketing folklore with one of the most memorable bits of commentary. But before we discuss it, I was just doing a bit of research there, and I came across a really interesting story from that moment. So there we are in Kolkata. It's the climax of the game. It's reaching the, you know, it's height. You're there on mic, but alongside you is David Bumble Lloyd, who we had on this show last week. He was talking.
All right.
Talking really beautifully about Shane Warne and Rod Marsh and the sad news of their passing. But run me through this story. So it was actually he that was on commentary holding the microphone in that last over, and then he passed it to you for the final ball. Is that the right story?
Yeah, that's absolutely 100% spot on. So obviously, for some folks that don't know, you know, and a lot of people know, but in commentary, if you've got two, sometimes you have three commentators, but in that case, we have two. So there's one guy who's a lead commentator, as you very well know, who's calling each ball. And then when the action happens, the color commentator comes in and describes, let's say, a boundary, and then it goes back to the lead. And Bumble was slotted in to lead that final stint. And at some point during that thing, he recognized where the game was heading and who was likely to come out on top, and he just said, you go ahead. But I was contented. I mean, there's video evidence. I was happy to fulfill my role, because I don't like crossing other people's role. I think it's very defined. So I thought, without sort of understanding the pressure that he put me on under at the time, now that I look back, it was a lot of pressure that and it was just very kind of him. That's who Bumble is. Very selfless, no ego in what he's doing. And I just sort of was driven by the moment, because the West Indies had come into that tournament with a little bit of a siege mentality. There were issues going around behind us, came out eventually with Samuels and Sammy and so forth. And there was a whole build-up to it. So yeah, Bumble, absolutely right. And it's pressure. Why is there pressure? Because in those moments now, you have to ensure that your words are suited for posterity, because those are moments that will be replayed time and time again. So I didn't plan anything. What you heard was spontaneous reaction to a situation. Thank God for that. It was the action on the field that defined the moment, not the commentary. I always say that to people. It was Carlos and Marlon who made that moment. Nothing to do with the gentleman shouting his stupid head off in the commentary box.
Those that don't remember the detail, just to give it a bit of context. So it was the last over. It was England against West Indies in the T20 World Cup final in 2016. West Indies needed 22 off that last over. Was that that was what it was? Was it 22? I mean, it looked like a fairly impossible task. But Carlos Brathwaite just started. And it was Ben Stokes was the bowler as well.
Yes.
It was the most incredible situation. Your commentary.
Marlon, talking to Marlon, actually, I think, I don't know where Marlon said it after, but the West Indies, I don't know how many people remember it, the West Indies had dug themselves into a hole, because West Indies cricket, as Sammy always says, great man, Darren Sammy, always says they're a boundary hitting team, a six hitting team. And I've always argued, Darren, too much focus on six hitting and not enough focus on scoring off more balls, and they dug themselves into a hole, and they ended up coming down to that last over. And I thought, there's a mountain to climb here. And Marlon said that he just said to Carlos, because it might have looked hopeless, he just said, you just swing for the hills when you get on strike there. There was no sort of planning of theories and hit it here and hit it, just swing for the hills. And that was beautiful. Carlos, God bless him, edged himself into cricketing history that can never be taken away. So that was it. Yeah, we can discuss more. Yeah.
And what was another lovely moment when they were presented with the trophy, that the West Indies women's team were also world champions at that time, and they all came together and wild celebrations with both teams showing their trophies to the world.
Yeah, the West Indies under 19 had won a little bit earlier in the year. The West Indies women's obviously had won earlier then, and then the men, and it stuck around. So it was a trifecta for the West Indies. And for Carlos himself, I've always told the story that the reason that those words came out, I'd been to a men's meeting. Sourav Ganguly had invited me to a business meeting the day before, and I'd speaking to, there was a question and answer segment with some businessmen who turned up, and one of them asked if there's anyone else to look forward to for the West Indies. And obviously it was Chris Gayle and those guys. And I remember Carlos was one that wasn't being spoken about. He was actually bowling superbly during that tournament. And we talked about fast bowling, Carlos and I, for the last couple of years leading into that, because he was trying to bowl faster and really was doing a good job in that tournament. And I just spontaneously answered a question and said, Carlos Brathwaite, he's built like a house. Remember that name, kind of thing. And so when the moment came, must have been subconscious that line just floated out. I didn't plan it, and it just came out. But Carlos's bowling in that final is not something that many people speak about. You go back and watch Carlos's final bowling figures, the people he got out, and you realize that perhaps he should have been the man that should have won all the plaudits there. And he did. People do remember him, that Carlos was brilliant. Ben Stokes, on the other hand, has had his redemption, as we said on air the other day. World Cup in 2019, he was the main figure, and he had divine intervention with the ball ricocheting off the bat, the headingly innings. He had the Bristol incident, as you very well remember.
Yeah.
But I was saying to Butch on commentary that, you know, when I really started believing more in Ben Stokes, he scored 100 in the IPL for Rajasthan Royals, I think two seasons ago down in the UAE. And his dad was ill. And we were specifically told, he's very emotional. Please, when you interview him, please don't ask him about that. Because he scored the 100 and given that sign that he and his dad had personal. And man, he came down there to the presentation and I had to interview him. And all I could think about asking was, what does that 100 mean to you? And you know when a guy pauses before he answers a question, he looks away. And that moment seemed like forever. And then he looked back and his whole expression changed. And then he talked about the fact that it means a lot to him because of X, Y, Z. And he almost cried. And that was the antithesis of the tough guy that I knew. And that's when I realized this guy is so human. And people don't recognize the pain that he's going through and has gone through in the past. A genuine fella, to a fault maybe, but a really superb guy. So I'm happy to see his redemption has taken place.
Interesting, very interesting. Bringing it to the now, you're in Barbados, as we know. One of the great cricketing occasions is West Indies versus England at Barbados. Many, many great matches down the years. It's a Barbados is, as we've said, cricket crazy. The atmosphere at Kensington, although it's not the same. There's I've got a problem with the amount of Brits that outnumber.
Okay,
you know, it's almost like a home game for England. But you know, I can remember going there in the 80s and 90s, and you know, it was conch shells, it was horns, whistles, noise.
Yeah, the whole crowd thing is not something that really started just this tour. I think we're going back a number of years where the visitors have outnumbered the locals, perhaps back to, I was trying to remember whether it was the last time I played against Mark Butcher in a test match here in 1998.
I was there.
You were there. Rampant. Yes, correct. I was trying to remember if there were little signs of that even back then. I know not too long after that it became a thing. So, look, we played some memorable test matches against England, and here in Barbados, 1990, I remember I heard Lloyd Barker, the umpire, on radio here talking the other day about when he gave Rob Bailey out caught down the leg side, and everyone was saying that it was Favre charging up the pitch, intimidating Lloyd Barker. Lloyd said, no, he's spoken to Rob since then. It was not anything to do with Viv. He just thought that Rob was out, and it took him a while. Great, lovely man, Lloyd. So I do think it's a wonderful occasion. I wish there'd been more local supporters, but if the visitors have more finance or it's skewed towards them, there's nothing that we can do about it until more locals decide they want to have a review of that old tape of guys crawling under the fence to watch Michael Holdings over to Jeffrey Boycott back in the 80s. The old YouTube footage of that is superb. So I think when you say the West Indies can take positives, yes. England can take positives, yes. I'm worried, though. I'm worried. If I take my commentator's hat and put it aside and speak to you as a former West Indian, I'm concerned that I so badly want the West Indies to win. But as an atmosphere, an England-West Indies match is so... I wonder if you remember when we played them up at Sabina Park in 1990 in a one-day game, and I had to hit four off the last ball to win the game off Angus Fraser. You probably would not remember that.
Yeah. That was a famous tour.
Yeah, I almost didn't make it out, because had I not hit that for four, they would have hung me, my clothing, up as an effigy at Sabina Park, because the ball before, Richie Richardson was at the other end, and he said, "Bish, wherever this ball goes, if it goes through to the keeper, you have to run." And Angus Fraser dipped this ball down the leg side, and it just passed on the outside of my pad, and I tried to leg glance it with fine leg up, and I missed it. And Richie was halfway down the pitch as it went through to the keeper, and I was just frozen. And I did not run. I forgot to run. And therefore, I had to hit four off the last ball. So if I had failed to do that, I may not have been here today. That was one of my great memories of a contest between the West Indies and England.
It's always great. And I don't share 100% of your pessimism, because...
No, it's not pessimism. It's not pessimism.
Yeah,
it's,
yeah.
It's my West Indian concern.
England struggle. They've always struggled in the West Indies. It's never been an easy place to tour. And the games have always been... incredibly well contested. So
why do you think?
Well, it's a place where England love to tour, and I think the West Indies, it's a case of settling lots of old scores, and
right,
you know, there's a lot of pride to be played for there,
right? But I would argue that when we played, yes, there was that pride for that, but there also had to be the pride for every encounter. The juices just flowed a little bit more, because Kirtley said, Kirtley, I never could put it this way, and he's a good friend of mine, he's my former roommate, who threatened to throw me off Shirley Heights one time as a roommate of his in Antigua if I didn't behave myself in the room. Those were the days of roommates. He said when he came into the team, the culture, he wasn't so much in tune with all the historical narratives, but just the culture of the guys who were more senior passing it down was what stirred him. And then as he learned about what Lord Larry Constantine fought for in the 1950s up in Liverpool, and what has happened up at Yorkshire since, all of those bookend why we should feel a sense of pride in playing, and our sort of cutting our own independence in the world. So I think there is that, but I still don't know that that helps a West Indies batting lineup to the level I would like to see. Come on, help me out. Seriously.
Maybe Chris Gayle can send some of those great big bats that he uses. And
it's not a bat. I'm not pessimistic, but I do have a little concern. I think our bowling is in decent shape. It's starting to come around. Jaden Seals is a lovely young cricketer. Kemar Roach will be outstanding at home. Jason Holder is brilliant at Kensington Oval all around. But the other guys need to step up. So if they can step up, I think we will have, West Indies will have the edge. If they don't step up, it could be a little tighter.
Well, we shall see. We all wait with eager anticipation because it's one of sport's great occasions.
Oh, thank you.
Let alone cricket. Now, before you go, on this show, music plays a big part as much as cricket. And with all of our star guests, we always like to ask for a musical request. And Ian Bishop, you are no exception. So we would like you to request a track just to play straight after this interview.
I hope that that comes off the internet, because you have no idea what I will ask you for. Because I am not a man who felicitates the normal West Indian thing of soca music and calypso and reggae and all of that. I am more of a man of the cloth. So I head towards gospel music. And so anything from Kirk Franklin, Wanna Be Happy, maybe, is something that I would gravitate towards. And I'm going to test you on that.
We'll find it. We will find it.
Oh, good. Good man.
And it's always eclectic. But this is why I love asking this question, because, you know, when people give honest answers, the musical requests and the taste of music are always so surprising. It's,
it's
incredible. Dinesh Karthik, when we had him on, same question, and he came up with a Coldplay track that he liked. I'd have never, ever said he would choose Coldplay.
Yes, one of the more, I suppose, modern, eclectic tastes of folks from the East, who's a very sort of westernized in his musical taste, I suppose. A mix.
Yeah.
Lovely kid, eh?
Lovely kid. Well, enjoy the cricket. We'll look forward to hearing your famous voice on the airwaves. And regards to the rest of the guys, if anyone else wants to come and talk to us, and
I'll talk to Kirkley. I'll talk to Kirkley and see if he can spare you a few minutes before he returns to Antigua after the series. And we'll try to do the game justice. Thank you so much for having me.
The truth can Kirkley Ambrose.
Oh, come the on, truth then. Can change.
What a fantastic interview.
What truth do to you?
And we did manage to find his track. So here we are, Kirk Franklin. And this is Wanna Be Happy, especially for Ian Bishop. What a fantastic guest. There's no one else I can blame if I'm not happy. Wasted time, but now I can see the biggest enemy, it was me. So I'm not happy. Cry yourself to sleep. Shout and raise your hands. It won't change a thing, child, until you understand. Preach. If you're tired of being the same, if you're tired of things not changing, it's time for you to get out the way. Don't get stuck in how you feel. Say, Jesus, take the wheel. He knows. But it only works if you wanna be happy. Look at yourself and say, don't you wanna be happy? Yeah. I just wanna be happy. But if I keep on giving my heart for people to tear apart, the healing will never start. So I can be happy.
Yes, Lord.
Will I ever be happy? Cry yourself to sleep. Shout and raise your hands. It won't change a thing, child, until you understand.
If I'm talking to you, then say,
if you're tired of being the same, if you're tired of things not changing, it's time for you to get out the way.
You've been there too long.
Don't get stuck. Jesus, take the wheel. He knows the
thanks to Ian Bishop for joining me. Excellent chat, that one. Keep it locked to Phoenix. John Chubb is up next with the non-league hour. I'll catch you again next Thursday at 6 for more 98.out.
If you're tired of you, then say,
I just wanna be happy.